There are a lot of benefits to living in a rural area, but sometimes having access to psychiatric help could be a problem. Larry Mueller here with me today. Dr. Art Walasek is a board-certified geriatric psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also president of the American Association of Directors of Psychiatric Residency Training. We'll be talking with him about the shortage of psychiatrists in rural areas. Maybe you've had trouble finding a psychiatrist. Join in. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show or email us at talk@wpr.org as we talk a little bit about rural psychiatry. And Dr. Art Walasek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on the program.
I'm wondering what's the definition of rural psychiatry and how it might differ from psychiatry in other areas?
Sure. So I think mental illness is very common across the state. The rates aren't necessarily significantly different in rural areas than in urban areas. I think one of the big differences, which you're addressing on this program, is access. Access to resources can be quite a bit more difficult in rural areas than in urban areas. But we tend to see kind of similar things in terms of depression, anxiety, substance use disorders, the main kinds of psychiatric conditions across the state. We do see a bit of a older population, especially in northern Wisconsin, and so that influences things a little bit in terms of the types of illness we see. But lots of similarities in terms of people suffering and needing help.
Yeah, and I suppose, and it sounds like it's very similar in many ways, but it must be a little different in terms of the kinds of problems that you see.
So, I mean, I think there may be greater issues in terms of some of the financial and social challenges. Parts of the state kind of hit harder by economic downturn, for example, may have an influence. Some of the fragmenting of normal social ties in rural communities. One of the strengths of living in a small town is that real community feel. But when those ties fray, then that can lead to greater problems with getting support and then higher rates of mental illness.
You know, in terms of farming, as you see farm sizes mm-hmm. get larger, mm-hmm. the number of farmers are probably fewer in some ways, and so there aren't as many people out there mm-hmm. for those kinds of social and community things that can help sustain.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we see a lot of consequence of that, of loss of some of those traditional structures that had been in place.
Yeah. Well, Chris in Wisconsin Dells has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. The sun is shining. I'm glad. this is a bugaboo of mine. I've been at times in my life very intensely involved in some mental illness care, and golly gosh, if you have to pay for it out of pocket, it's way expensive. Right now I'm on Medicaid, so that's not an issue. But I moved from Milwaukee County to Dane County to Columbia County, and now I'm in Adams County. And when I came out here, I called the social services people and I said, what's available, blah, blah, blah. And the lady yelled at me on the phone basically and told me that I shouldn't have moved out here. This is a poor county and they don't have any resources available unless I'm basically an invalid and blah, blah, blah. Well, Marathon County, which is right next door, has a very activist program and you guys should get these people on. They've been on Route 51 repeatedly. They have a bonding agency with the nonprofits, the social services people, and the churches. And they will help people, but I'm not under their jurisdiction, so there's nothing they can do for me, but I've talked to them about stuff. And I don't think that this should be at the vicissitudes of the individual counties. There should be statewide agencies that are dealing with overseeing all of this kind of stuff so that people are not falling through the cracks.
Yeah. Comment, Dr. Wallace?
A number of really great points raised there, and I'm certainly sorry to hear about the challenges that you had in terms of getting adequate access. Wisconsin does have a system of very county-based human services. It's different. Other states have different models, so that is a benefit in that local counties get a lot of local control, but it can be a challenge in terms of ensuring that all counties are providing uniform resources to all of their residents. I do want to highlight some, I thought, you know, really great points about some of the community resources that are available. You know, at least two that folks should be aware of are NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI Wisconsin is a very active chapter of that organization. They have a great website and lots of great activities, resources, support groups, educational groups around the state. And then a similar organization is called Mental Health America, and their local chapter is Mental Health America of Wisconsin. And they, too, they have a Find Resources in Your County kind of locator on their website. So the options can be a little thinner in some places, but they're often backed up by organizations like that.
And we'll get those organizations, if we don't already have them up on our Facebook page, we'll get those up on our Facebook page. So if you want to go to the page, the Larry Mueller Show, you can click on them and get hopefully get some help in that way.
I wonder, Larry, could I amplify one other point that the
sure,
caller made?
You bet.
She started with a bright, sunny day, and I think we often forget we live in a very northern latitude, and so there actually are higher rates of depression, especially in the fall and winter in Wisconsin compared to other parts of the country. And so light exposure is critical, and it's free, and it doesn't require access to mental health services. And so, you know, just morning light, 30 minutes. It doesn't even have to be a bright day. A cloudy day is plenty of light. So especially with the beautiful weather we have now, getting outside and getting some light can be important for treating conditions like depression.
Absolutely. Tim in Eau Claire has something for us. Tim, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering why it isn't just seen as health care. You know, mental health care is health care, and it should be, you know, I can go to a doctor and see a podiatrist or an endocrinologist. Why can't I go to my local health facility and see a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
I couldn't agree more with that point. I mean, I think we've had an artificial distinction between mental health care and medical illness. Mental illnesses are medical illnesses. They're illnesses of the brain and mind, and so there shouldn't be any dichotomies there. It's I'm not an expert in the history of healthcare delivery, but I mean, I think this is a relic of kind of how these systems were designed to have kind of separate mental health services from medical services. I will say there's been a lot of movement in the direction of parity. So mental health parity is the law of the land. We are supposed to be receiving the same level of mental health services as medical services, but I think the reality hasn't necessarily matched that.
Yeah, I'm talking today with Dr. Art Wallasek, a board-certified geriatric psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, about mental health, rural psychiatry shortages here in Wisconsin. I hope you'll join in with your own experiences or your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. It does get down, I think, to a question of numbers. If you're a psychiatrist, you need a certain number of clientele in order to be able to function. I suppose that's one of the big challenges, is just getting enough people out there.
Well, you know, I think there's unfortunately no shortage of patients for us to see. There's a huge shortage of psychiatrists. So the estimate is that we're down about 200 some psychiatrists across the state. So we certainly need many more mental health providers out there.
Why, just as an aside, why is that the case?
Well, a lot of it has to do with, really the rural nature of the state. Often physicians, especially specialists like psychiatrists, tend to cluster more in cities than in rural areas. The number of psychiatrists we can produce has basically been capped by Medicare. It's kind of a long story, but basically all residency training is in part funded by the federal government. It comes out of Medicare, and those rates have been capped for about the last 20 years or so. So expansion is slow and difficult. We were able to expand our residency through a very forward-thinking and generous grant from the state to expand our residency training, and Medical College of Wisconsin is doing something similar, but there's a rate-limiting step of how many psychiatrists we can actually produce each year.
We have more callers. Oop, we just lost a caller. You can join in again, 1-800-642-1234. Joan in Amherst up next. Hi, Joan. Thank you for calling.
I'm really glad to hear this topic being discussed. I'm a retired long-term care ombudsman, formerly with the state of Wisconsin. And I covered lots of rural counties here in central Wisconsin. And it was really very, very difficult when I had families with institutionalized family members or not institutionalized with complicated comorbidity kinds of mental health and physical health problems.
Well, yeah, first of all, thank you for your work as an ombudsperson. I think in my role as a geriatric psychiatrist, I've had some interactions with long-term care and long-term care ombudsperson, so thank you very much for your work in that. And that starts to get very complicated once you look into long-term care and ensuring that that residents of long-term care facilities are getting both good medical and mental health care.
Yeah.
And why is it so hard? Why can't the medical school turn out more psychiatrists willing to work out of metropolitan areas?
Well, there are kind of several steps there. One is on the medical school side, and medical schools across the country, including UW and Medical College of Wisconsin, have both expanded. Both schools have rural training sites across the state. So that's the first step. You got to get more doctors. And then the second step is they have to go through residencies. So currently about 5% of U.S. medical students go into psychiatry residencies. Most are going into primary care specialties. So that actually opens up another avenue for us, kind of helping ensure that primary care docs, who are often the ones who are left addressing these issues of mental health. Most mental illness care takes place in primary care. So one of the things we can do is better train folks in primary care to recognize and address mental illness. And so there are a number of programs underway to try to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you're, because of my experience, when you're in a nursing home, any licensed facility, there gets to be all sorts of regulations about the use of psychotropics to begin with.
Yep.
But they were always the most difficult cases and ones which I often felt I did not get good resolution to.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's all.
Yeah. Thank you, Joan, for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Art Walasek, our guest today, as we talk about rural psychiatry and the shortage here in the state of Wisconsin. Again, join in at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. KP Whaley, our on-air producer today on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll be talking about traveling around Labor Day with Rick Cini of FairCompare.com, so I hope you'll stay with us for that. Right now, taking a look, we have a whole series on mental health, and today we're looking at rural psychiatry and shortages that exist. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. What's it like, before we go back to the phones, what's it like for a psychiatrist working in a rural area? How different is it from the person who lives in Milwaukee or Chicago?
I can't speak from personal experience, but I've worked with some psychiatrists who work in rural areas, and of course we've trained people who have gone on to work in rural areas as well. I think on the challenge side, there are just fewer resources available, so you're kind of making do with less. On the positive, or maybe kind of making things more complex side, the psychiatrists are living within these smaller communities and running into the people they're taking care of on a regular basis, and so that can pose some interesting challenges of you're caring for your neighbor or someone you run into in the grocery store and so on, and of course we have to maintain confidentiality through all that, but that can get challenging, and you may be taking care of multiple members of the same family and so on, so similar to what family doc in a rural area might experience as well.
Well, Marcy and Seymour, it's your turn next. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I wanted to just give a shout-out to the National Alliance for Mental Illness that was mentioned earlier, and through my employment, I was able to take part in the youth first aid training, and I just want to encourage anybody and everybody to go ahead and take advantage of that program, because it just makes you more aware, it makes you more empathetic, gives you information, and it makes you realize that you don't have to be necessarily, a provider, but everybody can be looking for these things and helping our youth and helping each other and getting people resources that way. So especially in a rural area, when the more professional help might be a little bit further to reach, this is something we can all do for each other, for our youth, for our communities, and just encourage people to take advantage of that.
Thank you for that call. Dr. Wallace, comment.
What a wonderful point. I would add to that, I had mentioned the Mental Health of America organization earlier. They also do a lot in terms of peer support and peer advocacy. That's really become a big movement. So people who have mental illness themselves supporting other folks with mental illness. The VA is very into this model as well. So it's another just great way of looking beyond the traditional healthcare system to find resources for folks.
Marcy, thank you. I appreciate your call. Christine in Franklin, we turn to you next. Let's see here. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I have a question. I have a sister who is a paranoid delusional schizophrenic and has never been treated within the last 15 years. I mean, it was bad in the beginning where she'd be screaming and yelling at everybody, but now it's to the point where, well, she was downhill skiing, and they actually called the police and put her in the hospital, and she was supposed to go to court, and they said she would be brought back, but they didn't. They released her to go home. Even a person there that she was very close with, he actually called the police hoping she would get some help.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear about your sister's suffering and of course, suffer the impact on your family, too. One of the greatest challenges we face is the balance between taking care of folks, making sure they're getting adequate mental health care, and respect for their autonomy and decision-making. And this is one of the toughest balances in psychiatry. And it also leads to some of the biggest frustrations for family members who wonder, why can't my loved one who's suffering so much get the care they need? So unfortunately, we run into this on a daily basis, trying to figure out what's the right balance of respecting someone's own wishes who may be ill but not want to get treatment or not recognize that they need treatment with everyone else's family, society's concern about how they're doing. So it is a great challenge.
Oh.
Well, she went to her dentist, and she was, this is probably 15 years ago. She went to the dentist, and she said how people were out to get her, and they were going to get their just due or whatever, and he called the police.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in Wisconsin, as in most places, getting people treated against their will can be very, very difficult, and for good reason, because we want to respect people's autonomy. But typically, if someone's mentally ill and posing a danger to themselves or others right away, then they can get treatment at least immediately. But in other circumstances, it's much, much trickier.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for calling, Christine. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Love to hear from you. What is there a kind of a standard form or format of treatment of folks with these kinds of issues and problems?
Sure. So, in the what the last caller was describing, sounds like it's someone with pretty severe mental illness, and the kind of the gold standard treatment for that is community-based care involving psychiatrists, case managers, nurses, really a team-based approach, because medications solve part of the problem, but often folks need much more assistance in terms of housing and getting a job or help getting a job, socialization, reconnecting with family, and so on. So people really need much more wraparound services. And there's the concept of something called the recovery movement, where the focus is really on getting people, feeling better again, back on track, at least as much as using medications to try to reduce some of the symptoms.
Do we have many success stories?
Oh, I think so. I think one of my favorite success stories that I like to share, it's not a Wisconsin story, but it's a success story in general. There's a woman by the name of Ellen Sachs, S-A-K-S. She's a UCLA law professor, who suffers from schizophrenia and is quite ill. Her memoir talks about being about 12 or 13 years old and having some very frightening psychotic experiences. And she writes about and studies and teaches about mental health and the law. And she's a very inspiring speaker. She's got a TED Talk and so on. I think there are stories like that out there who people, even despite pretty severe illness, end up being quite successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to Denise next in Reedsburg. Denise, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Good morning. Thanks. I think this is such a very important issue, mental health. Sorry, I've been affected by it, by my family. I lost my brother to bipolar disease. And I feel like the biggest thing that needs to really be addressed is that whole autonomous issue you brought up. How, these people are left to be autonomous to make the decisions when they truly shouldn't be. They're left to go. I have dealt with Florida and Wisconsin. He was Baker acted in Florida, is what they call it. I've had him up here in Mendota Mental Health. And ultimately, he ended up committing suicide. Now, those people that are on the fringes, I feel, are the ones that are the biggest concerns and aren't adequately addressed, because we give too much freedom to the patient to be psychotic, to be, unwell. And that's their choice.
Yeah. I'm very sorry to hear about your brother, and we haven't touched on suicide yet, but that, of course, is the worst outcome of these illnesses, and most people who commit suicide have some form of mental illness, which ordinarily ought to be treatable, and so we would hope that we'd be able to reduce or even completely prevent suicide. So I'm very sorry to hear about that. It's such a tricky balance, because if you go back in time to like the 70s, we had sort of very much the pendulum was on the other end, where people could very easily be involuntarily committed and spent months or years against their will. And so a lot of the laws that arose since then were in reaction to that. And I think you could argue that things have kind of gone too far to the other direction.
Yeah.
But
The pendulum needs to come back a little bit, and I don't know if that's happening or what can be done to help that happen, because he's not an isolated incident. This is
right.
And the families are the ones left to try and sweep up all the messes behind them, to try and get them healthy when they have no idea they're not even healthy. It's everybody else's problem. It's everybody else's issue. Nothing is wrong with them. But clearly, after multiple inpatient hospitalizations, you still do not get any kind of leverage, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're right. I mean, the impact on families, on communities, I mean, it's just terrible. We see this all the time with suicide having such terrible ripple effects.
Yeah. Well, and the mania. And anyway, on and on. But I just wish there was something that there was more that we could do to deal with that and the patient rights issues. That I understand the whole HIPAA and all the rights, but mm-hmm. there's got to be a better balance than there is.
Yep.
Thank you, Denise, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Yeah, we have some firsthand experience here at the UW with one of our students who mm-hmm. was in sort of a similar kind of situation and committed suicide. How prevalent is it in Wisconsin?
So a great question. So, you know, suicide is the kind of number one awful outcome of mental illness. And the rates in Wisconsin are not significantly different from the rest of the state or the rest of the country, rather. In general, it's about 12 or 13 per 100,000 people per year commit suicide. And there are certain populations that are especially at risk. So we think quite a bit about late adolescents, young adults, as being at risk. So that's a period of a lot of turmoil in people's lives. There's a lot of drug use, a lot of transitions, and so that's a really risky period. There's been a lot of news lately about midlife as well. So especially men in their 50s, increasing concern about that group of folks becoming kind of increasingly depressed, disaffected, disconnected, and at risk of suicide. And then in my neck of the woods, in terms of patients that I treat, it's actually older adults who have the highest risk of suicide of any age group. So there are these pockets of higher risk, and people who have had recent loss, who are in pain, who have had medical problems, all those things amplify the risk. Many people in younger populations and most in older populations who commit suicide are depressed, and depression is treatable. So we ought to be able to identify and treat those folks and reduce the risk of suicide.
Mm. Have you focused or are you focusing on particular areas in Wisconsin for help?
Well, I can speak to our residency program and to Medical Colleges of Wisconsin. So we have a program now where we are placing our residents, so people training to become psychiatrists, in various settings around the state. So we have relationships now in Ashland, Wisconsin, in Lancaster, in Marshfield, in Waupaca, so in Monroe. So residents are currently or will be in the near future working with patients with mental illness in those various settings. The Medical College of Wisconsin has really taken on a very ambitious expansion of their training. They are going to have two new residency programs, two completely from scratch residency programs, one in Green Bay, and I believe the other one is in Wausau. And so they'll be able to train 7 more psychiatrists per year within those settings, and hopefully those are folks who would then stay in those areas as well. So all across the state, lots going on.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And is the attrition rate great, or how's it going?
Yeah, attrition in terms of people leaving rural areas, or psychiatrists leaving rural areas?
Yeah.
That I'm less sure about. I know that our residency is effectively a net importer of physicians into Wisconsin. So we have more people staying in Wisconsin than who came into our program. So we're kind of net Wisconsin converters, so we feel good about that. There's a lot of retirement in psychiatry. So psychiatry is a relatively older field in terms of the average age of psychiatrists. So that's one thing we're worried about. We're going to see a lot of retirements in the next 10 to 15 years, and we're going to have to try to keep up with replacing the folks who are retiring.
Let's turn to Kay in Madison next. Kay, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I missed the very beginning, but I just wondered if there's any progress being made in psychiatrists who specialize in gerontology. I mean, we're all getting older, and I've heard that there's quite a shortage of
Mm-hmm. In that area.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that question. So I'm biased. I'm a geriatric psychiatrist myself, and so I'm very invested in this topic. There's a huge shortage. So we have the capacity in this country to train about maybe 80, 90 geriatric psychiatrists per year. There are probably about 2,000 across the country altogether, but only half those positions get filled. And it's a kind of a complex story as to why that is happening. Some of it has to do with Medicare reimbursements not quite as good as private insurance reimbursement. There are probably a lot of other complex reasons for it, but we are way behind in terms of producing geriatric mental health providers. So some of our efforts are then training generalist psychiatrists to be better adept at doing geriatric psychiatry. So there's time within general residency programs for people to get those skills. Again, helping our primary care colleagues with identifying and managing depression and memory problems and anxiety and so on in late life. The UW's Division of Continuing Studies has a great continuing education program for people who want to social workers, nurses, case managers, other folks who want to learn about geriatric mental health issues. They have a great series. So there, you know, in pieces, there are these different components coming together.
And in terms of geriatric mental health, is there cooperation or working with the various businesses or homes for the elderly that exist around the state?
Yeah, so that's something that we end up needing to do quite a bit because many of our patients are residents of long-term care facilities or of assisted living facilities or adult family homes. So I'm not sure if there's kind of a high-level collaboration necessarily, but certainly on a day-to-day level, we're always working with the nurses, the administrators, the other staff, and home health agencies as well.
What do you think, or how do you think this type of health care will be delivered in the future, or maybe should be delivered in the future?
Absolutely. So, you know, one thing I haven't talked about is telepsychiatry. So it's the provision of mental health services by a video link, essentially. This is really taken off as a way of, you know, rather than people needing to drive 300 miles to get services, being able to talk with a therapist or a psychiatrist over a secure video link. So the VA has really made a lot of use of this, and a lot of other organizations have done it as well. And it's a very effective model. And for a lot of patients who might be anxious about seeking mental health care, it might actually be easier to do some of that through, you know, over the computer, essentially, rather than in person with a psychiatrist or other therapist. So I think that's a model that we'll have to look at quite a bit more in terms of delivering to rural areas.
That seems really promising to me. And I think in some ways, all right, you're not looking, you're not in the same room with a person, but there might be some advantages to for the patient of not having to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great model.
Joan in Watertown, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'll try to keep it very compact, and my question is this. What rights do parents have when they have an adult child who very obviously has some emotional mental issues and has basically pushed everyone out of her life, and it's affecting the nuclear family or the family, and it's affecting all those around her? What rights do parents have?
Well, I'm sorry. It sounds like a very heartbreaking situation taking place there. And the person you're talking about is over 21, I assume.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of harkens back to an earlier call about balancing individual rights with a very appropriate and understandable concerns of family members, and if if a family member is concerned about someone's mental health, then they can work through their local county human services to see if there are resources that might be available. In very extreme situations, we had talked about involuntary commitment earlier, there is a provision within state law that says that if three or more people are concerned about the mental well-being of a person, they can actually file a petition with the court to have them be brought in for a psychiatric assessment. And so it'd be the local county's Department of Human Services would be the resource on that. And I participated in a few of those myself as one of the three people who's concerned about someone's mental illness. But those are tough situations and require lots of effort and patience and time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And just one quick question, and then I would be done.
Sure.
Is that the place of residence for the person who shows the symptoms of mental health issues, or is that the location of the people filing where they live?
It's the county. It's the county of where the person lives that you have concerns about. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Sure. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's go back over some of the different organizations that people should be aware of and should be looking at for help.
Absolutely. Let me start with one that I haven't mentioned. One of the challenges of finding information is looking online and trying to sort out information from noise online. And unfortunately, especially in the mental health domain, there's a lot of problematic stuff online. So I would recommend the first place people look, if they're interested in learning more about mental illness, the causes, the treatments, and so on, paid by our own tax dollars, the NIH, or National Institute for Health. The one dedicated to mental health is called NIMH, the National Institute for Mental Health, and their website has wonderful resources on there for teaching patients and family members about mental illness. So that's where I would start if folks want to learn more about mental illness. In terms of organizations, we've talked about NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Mental Health America is another advocacy organization. Each county will have a Department of Human Services that will link to different resources in the community as well. There's something called ADRCs, Aging and Disability Resource Centers. So I believe every county has an, or most every county has an ADRC, and so they can be the link, especially for adults with disabilities and older adults, getting them resources.
Is that ADRC or AGRC?
I'm sorry, AD, disability.
ADRC. I wanted to make sure I had that correct, because KP Whaley, our on-air producer, I'll have KP put all of these up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, so people can just go there and click on those and find those various outlets for help. Dr. Walasek, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and I wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you very much for covering this very important topic.
Dr. Art Walasek is a board-certified geriatric psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, also president of the American Association of Directors of Psychiatric Residency Training. And those four organizations that he mentioned, we'll put those up on our Facebook page so you can just link right to them. We'll get that done very quickly. And thanks again to Dr. Walasek. Coming up, we're going to switch gears and talk with you about travel. Fall is a great time for airfare deals, and we'll learn more about that next from Rick Seney of FareCompare.com.